Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Yusuf Dahl, and when I was 18, I was convicted of selling drugs. For the past 3 years, I've had difficulty finding housing because it is legal in the United States to discriminate against individuals that have a past drug distribution conviction on their record for life. It doesn't matter if it was a hard drug like heroin or a drug that's now legal or partially legal in many states across the country. Like marijuana. The Thurman Amendment was introduced to the Fair Housing Act in 1988 by segregationist Strom Thurmond, and it's since been used to deny housing to all people. But because people of color are disproportionately jailed for drug charges, we are affected more. My goal is to overturn this amendment to start an end to housing discrimination that unfairly targets people of color. If you would like to join this movement, please visit ThurmanAmendment.org to learn more.
A message from the Fable and Folly Network.
Omniverse.
The Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program is for mature audiences only. This episode contains discussion of poisoning, infection, chemically induced mental health crisis, car crashes, death, harm to children, and abuse. Please listen at your own discretion. If you find our Stygian story simply scintillating, unlock further secrets at patreon.com/omniversemedia and cthulhumystery.com/support.
You find your phalanges aren't so frigid out there in the bitter cold, you can give some skin to the Bucktown Five for that fiery and seasonally appropriate number, Hot Mittens. I've turned up the heat, but I can still send a chill down your spine because this evening debuts a special event for the Yuletide from our frightening friends at the Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program, the Cthulhu Cthomentary Arcane Advent. Every Friday through December, they'll be exploring the clammy and viscous depths of Lovecraftian cinema. Oh, and would you look at that? It's December 1st. And a Friday. Well, that can only mean...
Do you hear that? In the cruel blackness of night, an unknowable evil from beyond time cries out. What dark deeds unfold on the streets of Arkham? And which unwitting souls, innocent or impure, will succumb to the maddening call? The Call of Cthulhu.
Welcome, friends, to the Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program's Cthulhu Cthomentary Arcane Advent. Here to paint your merry and bright holiday season with ghastly screams and indescribable colors. Cthulhu Cthomentary is our behind-the-scenes show where, normally, we do episode-by-episode excavations of Mystery Program, digging into all the historical research, literary secrets, Easter eggs, deleted scenes, etc. But, on occasion, we also examine Lovecraftian cinema, and that's what we're doing here in this Arcane Advent, 5 weeks of horror films for the holidays. You may have heard one or two episodes of Cthulhu Cthomentary in our main feed. We like to share them from time to time. But normally, these episodes are exclusive to our supporters on Patreon and supporting cast. The Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program is only made possible via listener support, so creating Cthulhu Cthomentary and other exclusive series, as well as offering ad-free episodes and early releases, are some of the ways we say thanks to the amazing folks who are able to aid us in telling these strange stories. In fact, this month on Patreon and supporting cast, our initiates are unwrapping an additional 5 Lovecraftian cinema cathomentaries. If you'd like to discuss these films with us, share your own hot takes or something we missed, shamble on over to our Discord. You can find the link at CthulhuMystery.com. Now, tonight you'll hear us talk about the 2019 adaptation of The Color Out of Space. And this discussion was recorded back in 2019 at the release of the film, when it had been announced that The Color Out of Space would be the first in a trilogy of Lovecraft adaptations from the film's director, Richard Stanley. In the years following this recording, Stanley was accused of domestic abuse, and the film's production company, Spectrevision, ended their relationship with him, canceling the remaining films in the trilogy and pledging all future revenue from the film to charities devoted to stopping domestic violence. Which is all to say that in this discussion from the distant past, we'll remain blissfully unaware of that disturbing turn of events. As a fan of H.P. Lovecraft's writing, I'm well practiced at separating art from the artist. So, won't you join us for an evening of sinister cinema studies? Ah, but who is us? I haven't even introduced myself. I'm Kat Blackard, the showrunner of the Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program, and with me is our keeper of arcane lore.
Hi, I'm Luke.
And we are pleased to present to you our Cthulhu Cthomentary discussion for The Color Out of Space, starring Nick Cage.
Yeah, at his Nick Cagiest.
No, this is not his Nick Cagiest. This showed great artistic restraint on his part while still wielding the manic beast that we all know and love.
True. Although I guess like in this case, though, it's with the whole family, like it's a family's descent into caginess.
Oh, that's true. They're all being very cagey, yes.
Yeah.
So this, I should point out, is going to begin as a spoiler-free review. And if at such a point we decide that we must uncork the spoilers, then they shall flow freely like so much tainted tap water. This is, of course, a direct adaptation of the H.P. Lovecraft short story, The Color Out of Space, which was published in, I want to say off the top of my head, 1929, but let's find out.
It's earlier than that, I think.
I don't know. I don't think it is. 1927. I was close. But I suppose in Lovecraft time, that's not close at all. Very prolific over a relatively narrow window. Oh, look at this lovely illustration they have on Wikipedia. That's very nice. I recommend going to the Wikipedia page for the original story and seeing a very interesting etching.
We should probably point out that we are like recording this like well after midnight.
It's 1 a.m.
Yeah, so if we're a little loopy, that's a big chunk of it.
We caught an early release screening that had a charming but brief Q&A with director Richard Stanley, Nicolas Cage, and some of the other cast members by surprise, and was hosted by Patton Oswalt.
It was nice to kind of hear a little bit about the background of the movie from them and kind of different people's approaches towards aspects of it.
Yeah, Nick Cage had a leather jacket with a B on the back of it, which really, I've got so many questions. I did an episode of Horror Queers on the 2006 Wicker Man, which is just one of the worst things ever. And
How'd it get burned?
Nick Cage produced that film. Like, he was really integral in making it, which I have so many questions about, especially because it's so misogynist. And like, listen to my Horror Queers episode. I get in some rant territory. But the B component is really fascinating to me because that's the most original part of that film. Because otherwise, it's just a absolutely horrendous remake of a masterpiece. And what they've done to it is inexcusable. But then there's this B stuff, and the B stuff is actually kind of interesting, but isn't given the opportunity to thrive. And does Nick Cage have a B thing?
Maybe. Ayo. But hey, if nothing else, besides the B stuff, the other good thing that came out of it is the animated GIF of Nick Cage running around in the bear suit punching people.
Yeah, that is a big mood. So I reread the original piece for this, and I also watched the film Mandy, which was by the same production company, the same editor, and also starring Nicolas Cage. The production company is Elijah Wood's company, Spectrevision, and they do cool, trippy films, it turns out. These are the only films of theirs I've seen. But, I mean, generally, if something has artistic merit but is not going to get produced by conventional means, then this is how you make these unconventional things. For instance, an H.P. Lovecraft adaptation where, it's relatively accurate.
Yeah. It's a story where there's no real antagonist. It's kind of really just a man versus the cosmos story.
Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't seen every H.P. Lovecraft adaptation. There are many, but they are generally very loose. Not many of them even have the same names as the stories they're based on. And as with most Lovecraftian things, they transmute quite a bit, though, in this case, usually for reasons of making the unknowable horror just a bit more knowable for general audiences, no matter how much they veer into grotesque perversities of darkness. But this might actually be the most to-the-letter H.P. Lovecraft adaptation that's ever been committed to a major motion picture.
Yeah, I'd say Reanimator's close. I mean, obviously Reanimator's played with a bit more camp. Like, it doesn't have a whole thing where, like, Herbert West goes off to war, that whole angle on things. But generally, like, it's very close to the original story.
You know, I haven't seen it. I know it's one of the big ones, one of the tentpole ones. But yeah, I've never seen Reanimator.
Oh, Jeffrey Combs, man.
And everyone loves him. And I think the reason I have a complete ambivalence towards him is not having seen that film.
Or not having seen a bunch of the latter-day Star Trek stuff. Well, I guess now mid-period Star Trek stuff. Like, yeah.
Well, was he an Enterprise or something? I mean,
he's the best character in Enterprise, like, full stop. Shran is the best character in Enterprise. Okay. But then also, like, he's, like, five characters in DS9.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's weird. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Huh.
Okay. Well, something for me to look into down the line. I'm sure it'll come around. Anyhow, this film, how'd you like it?
I enjoyed it. I thought it was pretty well paced. It was nice and creepy, and a lot of the weirdness out of it was not weirdness that happened in the ways that I expected it to.
Mm.
In all honesty, it beat my expectations, because kind of like you mentioned, you know, with adaptations of Lovecraft stuff and cosmic horror, things like that, it's kind of rough. And then
yeah.
There's not necessarily a lot of appetite in Hollywood for, like, you know, just kind of a grim story where things are kind of outside of the realm of humanity.
Right. Even horror has to have some degree of, like, an upswing at the end.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is not, would not be. I mean, I there are other adaptations of the story. And as I understand it, they're not what happened here. So if you need a frame of reference, the original Color Out of Space, the, you know, the one from 1927, therefore me talking about it is not spoiling anything.
No,
or at least it oughtn't to be. And if so, go ahead and read it. It's freely available. It's framed from the perspective of a surveyor who's doing surveying on a remote valley, I think just west of Arkham, where there's going to be a reservoir built. And like about 30 years prior in, dates are a little fuzzy, but sometime in the 1880s, there was an event. And there's this whole region that he wanders through called the Blasted Heath, where everything seems very dead. And there's only one person who will talk to him about what happened there, because the people in Arkham just sort of dismiss it. They call it the Strange Happenings, I think. Or the Strangeness. Strange Years. It wasn't years, though. It wouldn't have been years. Anyway, just off of memory. And essentially, the surveyor finds out that once upon a time, there was this family who lived out in the woods, normal people, just having a rural lifestyle, being pretty chill. They had a farm, they had plants, they had horses, they had cows, and a meteorite crashed, and it got into the well, and it seemed like it was no big deal. The stone collapsed in on itself. It got researched back in Arkham, but it was rendered inert almost immediately. They couldn't find out anything about it. And then things got real weird at the town. And this is from the perspective, this is told to the surveyor by the person who tells him the story. And that person who told him the story is the one who keeps checking on this family back in 1880, let's say. But meanwhile, it's probably 1927. So anyway, this family has this whole event where they slowly go crazy. Bad things happen one by one. They lose their minds a little bit. Get locked up in the attic. Terrible things happen to them. The fruit gets really big and gorgeous looking, but tastes like garbage. Kids drown in the well. There's something in the water. And that's the gist of it. Am I missing any crucial notes?
And then just as everything falls apart and turns to ash, it leaves as mysteriously as it came.
There you go. That's the other part. Yeah. It ascends. There's something just gestating down there, and it does whatever it was doing, and it turns all the woodland creatures into monstrosities of some vague variety. Just wrong. They're just wrong. And then and then it goes away. And the surveyor gets all this information. It's told to him with such a degree of severity that he believes every word of it, and everything that he's seen is so haunting that he quits his job. And that's the film. Goodbye.
Yeah, it's pretty close adaptation, definitely.
But in modern times.
Yeah.
And done with a degree of, like, I mean, it takes place just outside of Arkham. There's people wearing Miskatonic University t-shirts. They mention all the surrounding spaces, Aylesbury and Dunwich, so they prefer the Dunwich pronunciation.
Yeah.
And Innsmouth, and so on and so forth. Just littered with all kinds of Lovecraftian referential things hither and thither.
Yeah, and it doesn't really feel too forced that they're doing that. Like, it's just, that's the place they live. I just like the matter-of-fact way that, like, just Arkham gets talked about.
Yeah, like, it could have been, I don't know, Phoenix, Arizona, and surrounding principalities.
Yeah.
It's is directed by Richard Stanley, and this is an important point because Richard Stanley is something of a cult film figure. He did a film called Hardware and a film called Dust Devil, neither of which I've seen but are highly regarded, and I would like to see them. But he's perhaps best known as the person who wrote and almost directed the 1996 adaptation of The Island of Dr. Moreau, which is, of course, renowned for being terrible and a filmic disaster so bad that there's a documentary about how bad it went, which I haven't seen and only just today found out existed, the documentary, that is. Because I very much like parts of the story of Dr. Moreau. If it involves human-animal transformation, I'm probably going to be somewhat interested in it.
Yeah.
Or I should say human-other-special transformation, because we're all animals. So anyhow, he's been absent from the film industry more or less since then. There's been things here and there. But this is his return to film after a long time and being a big H.P. Lovecraft fan and also, I believe, a practicing pagan, which is a component that's been in his work quite prominently, including this one.
Yeah, definitely.
Though it rears its head in weird ways, not in the kind of ways that it rears when I do my writing. But the family is Nicolas Cage, the dad, and there's the mom, Jolie Richardson. Nicolas Cage plays Nathan. Jolie Richardson plays Theresa. Madeline Arthur plays Lavina, the teen daughter. Brendan Mayer plays Benny, the teen boy. And then there's also, I don't see him conveniently listed on Wikipedia, but there is little Jack, the little kid. And I believe, if I remember correctly, that is the same number of kids, but I think instead of a young boy, it was a young girl. I'm not 100% certain about that, but basically there are kids and terrible things happen to them. This one really focuses on the kid's perspective. In the short story, it's more like the guy from a few miles down the road interacting with the dad, Nathan Gardner. Lavinia, the teen daughter, she's the first member of the Gardner family that you see, and she is she's casting a circle and doing some kind of protection or healing spell on her mom who's suffering from cancer, some unspecified a variety of cancer. They are a pretty modern family, but living out in the woods. They've got alpacas. Mom is a stockbroker attempting to do it from a rural lifestyle. And there's a lot of really good tension building around all these components and the various like family and mundane stresses that really compound and are emphasized by what happens to them as they decline.
Yeah, I think they did a really good job in this with that family drama aspect of it.
Yeah.
The interplay, especially between the kids and how they treat each other and act around each other. Just the whole family dynamic, I think. Their little weird dysfunctional group. I like how they are together and kind of how that develops over time.
Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, because it's a faithful adaptation, like you have to understand that this is a film that is a kind of suffering to watch in a way that, you know, horror films are often a degree of camp and escapism that doesn't necessarily make you suffer unless it's got a psychological bent to it. And this one definitely does. I mean, because you're watching people who are being effectively poisoned. They're losing their faculties. There might be instances where it'd be like, you know, have the usual like, don't go in there. What are you doing? Kind of like horror movie things. But you can tell, especially based on their performances, their ineptitude or their lack of perception is because they are not operating with a full deck after a point. You know, their water is tainted and terrible things are happening. And the visuals are beautiful and stunning. You know, this is a color that can't be perceived by the human eye. And that's represented. It's mostly, I mean, let's be frank, it's mostly pink and fuchsia.
Yeah.
But like sometimes, like when it appears in the glint off of ice cubes, you're like, oh boy, this feels just like, if you're unnerved by notions of infection or radiation poisoning or any of that kind of like real world horror, this will absolutely trigger you.
Yeah. Just kind of the way that he plays with that. I liked the motion aspect of things, especially that scene where like he tries to start the car and then not exactly successful, as you go in your horror movies, but as he gets out of it and just the world around him is just writhing with motion.
Like, yeah.
I really liked that shot. And it just lingers on it. It's just so many things moving there.
Yeah. The psychedelia components of this film's art direction are they're present, but they're not present in a way that is in the least bit obvious or how you would necessarily expect it would be done.
Yeah.
Everything kind of has the appearance of almost being an in-camera effect, even when it's not. And I'm assuming that more often than not, it isn't. But yeah. I don't know. I didn't go to school for cameras.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I suspect a lot of it's kind of, you know, post-production, things like that. But then I'm sure they probably had like a lot of effort setting up lighting on some of their shots just to get as much of that, like especially with the reflections off of the glass and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, this is definitely a film that I would really relish some very technically oriented features just to see how it was done, because there's a lot of finesse here. I mean, this is the kind of project you get when a cult filmmaker comes back after like 20 years of absence and sticks a landing so much so that this is but the first in at least a trilogy of Lovecraft adaptations, all, you know, loosely interconnected, just as with all Lovecraft things are, our series included. And the next will be the Dunwich Horror, or Dunwich Horror, as I'm sure it will probably continue to be called. Luke, what's the official ruling on that?
I personally prefer Dunwich. Like, I just like it. It gives it kind of more of like an old world feel.
Right.
That's kind of like... Yeah,
Louisville, Kentucky.
Yeah. That's just kind of why I like that pronunciation. But I mean, there's not really any...
But you know when someone's an out-of-towner.
Yeah.
Which I think is like a very nuanced, real thing that helps ground things a bit.
So yeah, it's kind of that's why I like that kind of pronunciation on it. But yeah, that'll be interesting to see. You know, whereas Colorado Space is just straight up this family just experiences this thing that they have no control over and no real way to fight or even really interact with other than being acted upon.
Yeah.
And just dealing with it. Whereas like Dunwich Horror, basically that's as close as you get, I think, to an actual like Call of Cthulhu RPG as a Lovecraft story.
Right, this is like a premise.
Yeah.
And that's like a hard narrative.
Yeah, like there's things that happen in that. It's got a whole, yeah, exactly. It's very, very different. Very different.
Yeah.
So I'll be interested to see what they do with it. Because that's going to have, you know, yeah, characters doing things and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in a bad way, like not like nobody does anything in this movie, but like it's just a fundamentally different kind of story.
This is a character exploration.
Yeah.
It's seeing how people deal with these extraordinary circumstances and how their already like mildly but kind of normally dysfunctional life can be further altered by the extreme horror that they undergo as their faculties are taken away from them.
Yeah.
That, for me, made it a particularly painful watch, especially from just recently having seen Mandy. I wanted to see it for a long time, but that's a film that's also, like, that's a very gory vengeance film. Beautifully shot. Even more beautifully shot than this film. But it's about painful, terrible things happening to people. And in that case, there's kind of, like, I guess the fantasy of enacting revenge, except that, like, that it's done intensely, but not in a way that's any kind of, you know, vengeance is sometimes just, but it doesn't necessarily feel like there's no catharsis for the loss. You know, there's no real catharsis there. It's just pain. It's just pain enacting more pain, in this case, against very evil forces that definitely deserve it, which is great. But with Color Out of Space, it's a lot of suffering. It's a lot of like some people die in car crashes and some people die slowly from cancer, and some people start dying from cancer and then also have unfathomably horrible things happen to them as a result of a happenstance meteor crash.
Yeah. And one thing I kind of enjoyed about this is that there were kind of some elements to it that I didn't quite expect to happen.
Yeah, there's more. They do more to the story.
But it never felt like the color is unpredictable in how it works, but it never feels like it's breaking its own laws. And like for me with horror movies, like I find that important, like especially ghost movies. It's kind of off topic a little bit just to talk about ghost movies for a second. But to get where I'm coming from on this. So like ghost movies, the thing about ghosts is ghosts are creatures of habit. Like fundamentally, that is their reason for being, is a ghost is someone who hasn't let go of a thing and they do a thing and they do that thing and they're a ghost. So then like, so that's one thing that fascinates me and that I enjoy about ghost movies is like the exploration of the rules behind them. And then you've got like, what the hell was it? Cell, I think it was.
The Cell?
No. Some damn stupid movie where the ghosts follow people through cell phone calls or something stupid like that. I can't even remember what it was. But that irritated the hell out of me because they spent the whole movie establishing the rules and then they break them. And like not even in an interesting way where like, oh, shit, I hadn't thought of that. It's just like, oh, no, this ghost doesn't actually follow rules. And it irritates the shit out of me. I don't mind that the former one where it's like, oh, man, yeah, there is a whole complicated extra layer to this ghost. That makes sense. But if it's just like, oh, no, doesn't actually have rules. The color, the kind of things that it was doing and the way it was infecting people and yeah, like you said, poisoning them. Like it felt like it was a its own kind of cosmic sense as things kind of unfolded. They all kind of tie together in different ways, that sense of corruption and toxicity.
Yeah. This is a very satisfying adaptation in how it takes the source material and expands on it, which is something that, you know, we haven't done yet on Mystery Program, but we very much have plans to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so seeing this done in this way was very satisfying. And I felt like, oh boy, like here we are. Like this is a very kindred project in a lot of ways to what we're doing. Though I suppose what's difficult about the story is it's the misery of what happens here cannot be excised. It has to be as horrendous as it is. And that is something that I find extraordinarily difficult. But I think it's honest to its material. And one thing that I was really intrigued by was Lavinia's pagan practices. As the surveyor attempts to identify what it was, he asks her if she was practicing Wiccan or Alexandrian.
Mm-hmm.
And he guesses Alexandrian, and she says that he's wrong. I'm not familiar with, like, I know the rigidity of those practices are not something that I know enough to know that's not for me. But I'm wondering if maybe, like, the joke is that their last name is Gardner, so it was Gardnerian. But then also, if it was Alexandrian or Gardnerian, then she would have been doing that Skyclad, which would have been a totally different opening sequence. But I don't know. Sorry.
Yeah.
That was my hot takeaway. So it was interesting because, like, she's the most different character, the most present character. You know, that you can expand on any character in the story, and that's easy to do because they don't have much material in the original story.
Yeah.
But hers was the one where, I mean, she has, I'm not going to say that yet. We can talk about that later.
Her book?
Yeah, her book. Yeah, she has a book and she does some things.
Yeah, I've got some thoughts on that.
You know what? We've said enough. We've already said, like, hey, if you know the story, then you know how this ends, which is a pretty big spoiler, I suppose.
Yeah.
So right now, we're going to go to Spoiler Country, USA, in the county of Arkham? Wait, what county is it? Do we know that?
I think it's Arkham County.
Arkham
but
County.
I could be wrong.
Arkham City.
It might be Miskatonic County. I don't remember.
We use references a lot.
Yeah.
So not all of it's logged away in our memory banks.
Looking to get out of the ads and back to the story? Fable and Folly Plus is a new way to support the creators you love. The podcast you're listening to right now, and more than 60 others, can be heard ad-free for as little as $4 a month by visiting fableandfolly.com/plus. And now, the Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program is offering bonus content to Fable and Folly Plus supporters, including character creation and how-to-play episodes, plus cast and crew outtakes, all still entirely ad-free. Fable and Folly Plus, Sign up today at fableandfolly.com/plus.
Lavinia has a paperback copy of the Necronomicon, which she uses to attempt some kind of ritual involving a lot of scribbling in her skin with the razor blade, which apparently does nothing unless it's interpreted to have provoked the color greater. But I don't think that was what they were getting at.
Yeah. So that's kind of a whole interesting angle, that like bringing in the like the mass market paperback version of the Necronomicon, because like in a world where Al-Azif, the Necronomicon exists as a thing, and especially where, like, you know, one of the things which will come up in the Dunwich Horror, which is over time you end up with increasingly corrupted editions of it as it's just like translated and copied and translated and copied.
Right.
That's the whole reason that Wilbur Whately tries to break into the Miskatonic University Library, which is to get the Latin copy.
Yeah, that's some Series 2 of Mystery Program material that we will get to soon enough in this program, but yeah.
So with it, the idea that if you're dealing with stories in modern day, the Necronomicon, you know, would be a thing. It's kind of a cornerstone of the mythos. And so the idea that, like, there is this mass market copy floating around that is, like, some incredibly degenerated version of it and is just full of elements of poetry taken from the original and rituals sheared of their original context and things like that, to where...
Yeah, if you don't go mad from reading it, then... I mean, if she's a perfectly functional, normal teenager who has a copy of this book, who has read it, and is still completely functional and normal, then it's not... obviously, it's not the real deal. She also had a copy of Aleister Crowley's Book of the Law on her bed at one point.
Yeah, I saw you trying to crane your head to see what she had on there.
One of the other books was a Joseph Campbell book on goddesses.
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting to see. I mean, then again, you know, not everybody reads the Necronomicon and goes nuts. I mean, Professor Armitage, he had read it and then does a cram session on it before rolling out to Dunwich.
Yeah, I got some questions. Were there moments throughout the film where you were like, shit, roll a sanity check? Like, because I feel like there were some real, there were some pauses where, you know, something will happen. And I'm like, you can just, this is where you pause the video and you roll to figure out, like, how bad this hit them.
Oh, man. Yeah. The scene where she just is cutting those carrots.
Ugh.
I had to roll that then myself. But actually, I'm kind of able, like, even though, you know, I absolutely adore the game, like, I'm able to kind of, most of the time, especially if I'm watching it in theaters, just sit back and enjoy it on its own merits, and then later on kind of reappraise it in that context.
Yeah.
So, like, in all honesty, I wasn't really thinking about it. I was just letting the experience wash over me.
Yeah.
But afterwards, yeah, I did kind of consider that, because, like, that was one of the things that I specifically, like, along those lines, I was like, man, what would the stats be on the mass market paperback version of the Necronomicon?
One of the biggest departures of the film from the short story is the horrendous and awful thing that happens to Theresa the mom and Jack-Jack the little kid when they get fused together by some inexplicable purple lightning and into one gasping beast with two backs kind of thing. It was awful. Just atrocious what happened to them.
Yeah, yeah, that's... When it first happens, I'm like, oh, wow, they're horribly burned or something, not like maybe like half melted or whatever. Yeah, it surprised me.
it is a genuinely very, very fucking disturbing, and like, and does a good job of being like, it's so horrible, and you see it in glimpses. It's got there's a lot of, I feel like there's a few pages from what John Carpenter did in The Mouth of Madness here, which is you do see atrocious, awful things, but generally you see them only in momentary glances, just enough to let your brain fill in the rest of the blanks. And you do see quite a bit of this mom-son fusion creature.
Yeah.
But even still, you don't really get the whole picture ever at once enough to have any chance of becoming comfortable with it, and it maintains being awful the whole time.
Yeah, especially because, like, they're shifting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every shot with them is a little different, and the kid is in a slightly different place, like on her back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the sound design was very smart in this film. there were lots of little subtle things that were done, like especially with that creature slash character, of making sure that you were always hearing both characters, like breaths and crying and like different things. So even if you couldn't see one of their faces, in more often than not the little kid, you were definitely hearing them, and it was horrible.
Yeah. 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 It was, that's the thing, is they just did a lot of stuff that I didn't expect, which, I enjoyed. I was glad to see. The mother and the son, like, that was one of those things where there were a lot of elements to this that kind of start out in kind of almost a kind of a stereotypical way, and then it just kind of takes a left turn. Like the little kid being tuned in to the creepiness and just kind of like being absorbed by it in a way, you know, like The Shining with yeah. you know, Danny riding around and just experiencing all the weirdness. And just, it's a common horror trope where you've got the littlest kid is the one that is like talking to their invisible friend and all of that. And in this case, you know, the little kid being absorbed by the weirdness is much more literal in a way that I had not expected to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. There's elements of like mycelial horror, like mushroom oriented, mm-hmm. kind of like fungal horror, which is
mycelial.
Yeah. and that's something that doesn't come up too often. Like there's things like that like X-Files episode where they all get kind of like cocooned. That's sort of that. There's little bits of it in here. Like when in the fusion, there's like these, you know, you can never really tell what's exactly happening there, but there's these things that are either, they're either boils or they're growths or some kind of like mushroom thing like on that conjoined form. And the infection is so in all things, in the static of the television, it's in everything, like a big mycelial network communicating with itself in its own alien way and its alien patterns, and it's kind of like almost like breathing. It gets to the point where like it's like the whole landscape is one big breathing organism. So when it erupts and evacuates finally, it's like an abduction of the entire land, which has become corrupted. And one little component that was particularly interesting in a little element of synchronicity is there's a scene where Nick Cage is showering and there's this thing blocking the drain, and there's like hair in it, and it's got this whole like, you know, like gross shower horror stuff. But then like it's like a scoby, you know, like this weird like little like almost like a jellyfish growth that like you just get it for a split second and it goes away.
Yeah.
Earlier today, I was just I read this just bizarre story because Colin has gotten me on this kick of kefir. How you get these little grains, and they're like they look like, I don't know, kind of like rounded crystal things, and you put them in a sugar water liquid and they sort of ferment and it creates this probiotic drink.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like a quasi-yogurt drink, right?
And that's milk kefir.
Okay.
I'm doing water kefir. So it's more like kombucha.
Yeah.
Depending on how the different ways you brew it, it can become kind of vinegary or sweet, and you mm-hmm. mix fruit with it and all kinds of stuff. So like we have a septic tank at my house, and I wanted to make sure that in the instances where kefir particles get down there, grains get down there, they're not being like fed by all of our waste in an aggressive way that could say destroy or hurt the septic tank. Mm-hmm. And it turns out from what little I read, it looks like that's not the case. In fact, it's probably good that they're there.
Yeah, if anything, I would think it would be like the opposite.
Yeah. But in that search, I found this story, which comes from Altamont Springs, Florida, right down the street, and pertains to a weird kind of similarity to this shower scene. While picking up my weekly milk order from my farmer, I mentioned that I wanted to return a quart jar to her for more cream, but that all of mine were full since I had made so much kombucha recently. She asked whether I had any extra mushrooms since she wanted to start making it again. That led to a discussion about the mushrooms themselves. She uses hers 3 times, then throws the oldest one away and cuts her others into small pieces, and then uses those 3 times, etc. That way she's always using fresh mushrooms. When she first started making kombucha, someone told her that they were good for septic systems, so she was flushing the old mushrooms down the toilet. A couple years later, the septic tank guy came to empty out her tank, and he opened it up to stick the hose in to start draining it, but he couldn't. He was totally baffled and had to get out his knife and hack away at the large, tannish, leathery thing that was floating at the top of the tank. She was quite sure what it was, and she was quite sure she was not about to tell him. Can you imagine a kombucha mushroom the size of a septic tank? If only someone in the sci-fi industry knew about scobies. Said Lee Burdett of Altamont Springs in, I don't see a year on this post, but yeah. So that was odd. That was like, I mean, cutting through a giant mushroom growing in human waste so thick you can't puncture it with a hose, you know, like that's a thing.
Yeah.
That's a real thing. What other spoilery things do we want to discuss?
I thought Tommy Chong was used pretty well.
Tommy Chong was great. He's a treasure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really good dissemination of, like, especially his tape at the end. That was like, you know.
That was a really good scene.
Yeah. Like, in using some pieces of dialogue that were, like, lifted almost directly from the original piece, sort of, like, offering a homespun explanation for what it could have been that's, like, at the very least within the context of the story seems to be relatively true.
Yeah.
And then also the hydrologist,
the kid from Miskatonic.
Yes, the would-be surveyor. His intro and outro monologues are practically verbatim from the original story.
Yeah,
and I've been thinking about, since rereading the story, I've been thinking about where it exists in the actual, like, hard timeline of Mystery Program, because I have a working timeline that's got all of the key Lovecraftian mythos things synced up to real world events and synced up to our own events, just to make sure that I have a, it's hard for me to write historical fiction without having like a really big
solid timeline.
Vantage point. Cause otherwise, you know, like, especially having the understanding of like, what were these people going through? What else was happening in the world at that point in time? Mm. I have to be able to see it. And like, I don't have enough of an inherent understanding of it without. So I use this like, you know, visual tool to help me with that. And so there was some flooding that took place that I haven't researched yet. I think it was in Vermont. And then, like I said, it was in the 1880s when allegedly the instance happened with the color. And then it was written in 1927. But it was based on, in theory, that idea of the reservoir and all that was based on an actual reservoir project that was happening. Mm-hmm. But didn't end up getting completed until 1939. Mm-hmm. So relatively like mid-late 30s, if we use the actual reservoir that this project was based on as a notion for when and how this reservoir thing would be implemented in our own continuity, it would happen sometime in the mid-late 30s. Yeah. That the Arkham water would be dubious. Because like what happens here in this film is it appears that it evacuates entirely. They don't really give much of a hint that it's still around aside from like a bug.
Yeah.
But in the story, it sort of acts like the meteorite wasn't necessarily one thing. It was almost like some eggs, and some of them burrowed deeper than others. And like one ascended, but there may still be another one down there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the kind of like real notion of there is a ticking time bomb, like definitively a ticking time bomb somewhere underneath the water, which is fucking horrifying, especially if we start letting ourselves dwell on modern day problems like resource scarcity and all that, you know, like it gets really bleak real fast.
Yeah.
One other thing I wanted to mention that I'm musing on really more than there's not really a point to it, but on the television at one point in time, there's a film starring Marlon Brando, and Brando and Richard Stanley had a positive relationship during the course of making The Island of Dr. Moreau.
Yeah.
They bonded over Brando's character Kurtz from Apocalypse Now because of Hearts of Darkness or Heart of Darkness. And they had some kind of connection. Of course, like there are other much bigger problems, not the least of which was like, I think Brando's daughter committed suicide or something, that like really just one of the many elements that really fucked that film's production up. And I'm sure Brando's heart, probably. So I don't know what his appearance in, I don't know what film it was. I have no idea what film that was. It was in Color Out of Space. And I don't know what it means, but it definitely means something.
I think it's just a little personal kind of nod from him. I mean, that was the movie that kind of pulled him out of Hollywood.
Yeah.
It definitely had a profound impact on his life as a director and, you know, screenwriter and all that. So,
yeah.
And if, you know, he doesn't bear any ill will towards Marlon Brando.
Well, no. Yeah, I think this is probably a very specific, like, love letter of some kind. Like, I think it's really like the selection of the film and the scene from the film. I couldn't really make out the dialogue too well, but I feel like there's probably a message there. Like, it probably means something specific. And it's a positive thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know what it is.
Yeah. It's probably kind of a personal thing.
Probably. Yeah.
That's my guess.
Yeah. It could have been something that they bonded over, like, oh, yeah, here's an obscure role. But they, you know, like they had some kind of mutual appreciation. I'm not sure. But interesting.
Yeah.
Also interesting is the really shitty, aggressive mayor of Arkham.
Yeah. You should have sold when you had the chance.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like if there's any, like, you know, I'm going to eye roll a little bit. Cinematic universe, like, seating that's happening in this, she's at the epicenter of it.
Yeah, potentially. But, like, I don't see where she would come into the Dunwich Horror in the same way. Like, because this is, I mean, I don't know. A mayor makes sense here because, like, you know, there's property issues like that. You know, weird stuff happening. I think if anything, it would be Ward as the Miskatonic U alumnus.
Maybe. He's certainly a candidate. She just seems like a real easy thorn in someone's side. When a problem gets so big that someone needs to do something about it, she's exactly the person who's going to make sure that nothing happens.
So she's going to be like, what are you doing with all those shotguns and insecticide spray canisters, Professor Armitage?
Yeah.
Why don't we go talk about it down at the station? Sheriff, arrest these elderly men. They're up to no good.
Yes, it's true. This mayor has no dick. I guess that's it. It was good and you should see it, but do prepare yourself for something quite bleak.
Yeah.
On a scale of Happy Feet to Dancer in the Dark, it's not Dancer in the Dark. It's maybe, it has too many laughs for Dancer in the Dark. So it's...
Actually, speaking of that, the laughs, I guess that's kind of an interesting thing with it. It's interesting how that's all front-loaded. Like there's a fair bit of comedy in this movie, and it kind of, like, drains away as things get weirder and more corrupted. Like, I mean, there's still, like, occasional, but it's like, mostly, like, just, like, creepy, uncomfortable laughs.
Yeah, it depends on how,
yeah,
how much you're internalizing the experience or not. Because if Nick Cage freaks out and you're just inclined to be like, oh, Nick Cage, what a card. It's like, I mean,
yeah,
it's the same thing as, like, that gag from early Family Guy of, like, oh, Tom Hanks, everything he says is, like, is a laugh right. I have AIDS. You know, like, it's how connected are you or not to what's actually happening on the screen?
Yeah.
Because if you are connected, then all Nick Cage's weird acting and his, like, when he starts slurring and getting that kind of Valley Girl accent of his that he has on occasion, like, yeah, and you realize, oh, that's not him being weird. That's like this guy's losing his mind and not able to really talk right anymore.
Yeah, and that's one thing I thought was really interesting was, like, that aspect of it where it's kind of, you know, like a lot of mental issues that people will have, they'll have moments of lucidity, and that happens a lot in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, especially where, like, he's going nuts, like, just munching down on these rotten, terrible fruit, and his wife's yelling at him, and everything's like this like increasing tension in the scene, and then it's just like, yeah, that's a good idea, honey. And it was just like that line is delivered so normally,
yeah,
that it makes it, like, extra unsettling.
Yeah. And that's an instance where, like, it is unsettling. It is still okay to laugh there.
Yeah.
But it should be nervous laughter.
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Yeah. It was a lot of uncomfortable laughter towards the middle, later part of the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, it really, truly does thrive on, you know, I mean, if you lose yourself, if you're like, if you have, like, blood sugar issues, if you have any kind of chemical imbalance, like, if you're the instances where you actively feel you're losing yourself, even if you're having your period and you're just like, I know I shouldn't be acting like that, but I am, and fuck, and, like, why? Like, especially when those sort of things, like, get exacerbated in, like, in a real, like, challenging self-harm, like, mental dangers and so on. Like,
yeah,
this film really taps into that and performs that in a way that is not necessarily, like, 100% thorough, but it does it more than most ever do, and it's subtle when it starts.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, that first time he really, like, starts getting into the weird voices and just flips out at the kids and then just, like, runs upstairs and he's like, yeah, I just blew up at my daughter. I'm not winning any Father of the Year awards this year.
Yeah, which is like, that's what he's rationalizing to himself now that he's gone upstairs. But boy, when he was downstairs, nothing he was saying made any kind of like, it was just like, I can't even imagine being on the end of that kind of like beratement and thinking like, wait, is that normal? Like, and the father child or the parent child dynamic of like, when you're a child, you don't necessarily have the perspective to view your parent as a full, well-rounded person. You might not necessarily perceive how that behavior is as erratic as we as third-party audience members can view it as. You are coded to feel like regret or shame or whatever other things like come with being yelled at by your parent. And so the kids behave in a realistic way of like, not, they don't say like, that was weird, right? They don't really have that moment, but we know it was weird.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it kind of, especially Benny, like the boy, when he's talking with, what's her face? Lavinia. Like he's like, dad's being weird, right? But in a way where he's like, he's not sure how much of it is like, you know, is normal or how much is not. Yeah.
Yeah. They can't trust anything, and they can't trust themselves, and they can't trust others. And their trust is consistently betrayed by every facet of the way that they interface with their reality, which is just an awful nightmare to be a part of.
Yeah, the characterization and all of that, I really enjoyed how that played out in this movie. I thought it was pretty good pacing-wise and structurally, like the story that it did tell.
Yeah, unlike this episode or review. It's so late and I'm so sorry. We've been rambling quite a bit.
Yeah, but I've been up since like 6 a.m.
Oh, so. Luke, shit. Please be safe on your way home. You wield my director wand, and I'm gonna pull the plug now. Those are not complimentary visual metaphors, but it is ending. Thank you so much for listening to Cthulhu Cthomentary. If you have any thoughts on the film, please do share it on our Discord, and we'll talk to you soon.
Adios.
Adios.
Adios from those hosts, but hola to yours truly. We'll see you next week, Feliz Navidad Friday, here on WIS for another installment of the Cthulhu Cthomentary Arcane Advent. What's in store? Well, I hope you're still keen to be seeing through those rose-colored lenses, and have your Tilling Gas Resonators handy because we're going from beyond. From beyond where? Well, I guess to your ear holes. Over the old airwaves. Nice and crisp in that cool air. But our initiates on Patreon and supporting cast have an additional destination. They're paying a visit to the seaside to visit that jolly old ocean god, Dagon. To get access to this and our entire library of Cthulhu Cthomentaries and exclusive actual plays, head to CthulhuMystery.com/support. You know, I should put some decorations in this studio because, though the holidays are very much upon us, here in this windowless box, Christmas time seems years and years away.
In a garden fair sat a happy pair.
Thanks for listening to the Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program. This series is made possible thanks to the generous support of our producers, Amber Devereaux, Becky Scott Fairley, Bob Hogan, CB, Joe Tancrisiardelli, Josh King, McDribble Deluxe, Mjolnir MK86, Patrick Webster, Sean Hutchinson, Sean T. Red, and our executive Patreon producers, Big Bad Shadow Man, Marcus Larson, and Jamieson Lalone. You can join the team at CthulhuMystery.com/support. And if you enjoy this podcast broadcast, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or Spotify. The Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program is recorded and produced in Orlando, Florida, and Louisville, Kentucky, on land stolen from their indigenous people, the Timucua and Seminole, and Shawnee, Cherokee, Osage, Seneca, Iroquois, Miami, Hopewell, and Edina. Acknowledgement of the first peoples of these lands and the lasting repercussions of colonization is just the beginning of the restorative work that is necessary. Through awareness, we can prompt allyship, action, and ultimately, decolonization. For links to aid indigenous efforts and to learn more about the First Nations of the land where you live, visit CthulhuMystery.com/landback. Our original score is composed and performed by Ryan McQuinn and Mike McQuinn of Neon Dolphin. Home for all your custom music needs and more, neondolphinmusic.com. This has been the Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program. Good night.
Omniverse.
The Fable and Folly Network, where fiction producers flourish.
The buyer awaits your decision, poised as one both ready for a fight and assured of its outcome. I'll have that relic now.
That cool pretty boy have more healing. We gonna need it.
You guys might. One of you dies and I'm running for it. So don't.
We'll have to use every advantage, and we've not many left.
So, I'm confused. What am I supposed to say to him?
Marcus, it's a role-playing game.
Right.
So, you're this holy guy, Benedict.
Right.
And he's just joined this adventuring party.
Right. Why?
Because we needed someone to heal us and not ask questions.
Dom!
What?
Any reason you want, Marcus. That's the great thing about this game. You can be anyone you want. Do anything you want, for any reason, so long as it's true to your character.
Cool. I totally got this.
Wait, but...
This artifact belongs to my church, and as such, I cannot part with it for any price. What did I say?
Kill them all!
The Ordinary Epic, a podcast series about the extraordinary, the ordinary, and something in between. Listen now at theordinaryepic.com or on your favorite podcast app.